A Hindu student upon his return to India frankly said, "If those Christians in America had loved me a little more and my soul a little less, I might have become a Christian." What an indictment. The New Testament illustrates again and again that communicating the Christian gospel depends upon warmth and closeness. The Master was able to close the distance between himself and other people because he was willing to let his life be absorbed into the life of another. It is necessary to put a loving act at the very beginning of our relationship with other people. And it is impossible to love another without listening to him. Recall how Jesus so often stood at attention before a person who was asking for help. When all of his disciples could think of one thing, send them away. D.T. Niles, the great Burmese Christian, is of the deep conviction that we cannot commend the gospel to our contemporaries unless we can enter into their frustrations and their expectations and then address the gospel to ourselves as we stand in their situation. He even goes so far to suggest that if we will listen to Hindus until Hinduism becomes an attraction to us, if we will listen to communists until communism becomes a temptation to us, if we will listen to Muslims until Islam begins to attract us, then we shall be in a position to get the gospel across to them. One of the most delightful books ever written is the fanciful tale entitled The Little Prince. If you've read the story, you know that His Majesty lived alone on a tiny planet no larger than a house. He possessed three volcanoes that came up to his knees and a common flower that he tended with the utmost care. But one day he decided that he wanted to explore the great world beyond, and so he left his little planet and traveled to the earth. And there he learned from a fox the secret of what is really important in life. One day as he lay whimpering in the grass, lonely and unhappy, a little fox appeared on the scene. And the fox said, "Good morning." Immediately, the little prince wanted to play with him. But the fox said, "Oh, no, this cannot be, because I am not tamed." And the little prince said, "Oh, forgive me. I was just interested in making friends. But tell me, what does this word tame mean?" And the little fox replied, "It is an act too often neglected. It means to establish ties. Just that. For to me, you are still nothing more than a little boy, just like 100,000 other little boys. I have no need of you, and you have no need of me. And to you, I am nothing more than just a fox, like 100,000 other foxes. But if you tame me, you will have need of me, and I shall have need of you. To me, you will be unique in all the world. And to you, I shall be unique in all the world. But one only understands that which one tames. Men nowadays have no time to understand anybody. They buy things already made in the shop. But little prince, there is no shop anywhere on earth where one can buy friendship. So men do not have any friends anymore. If you want a friend, you must tame me." "But what must I do to tame you?" asked the little prince. "You must be very patient. First, you will sit down at a little distance from me, like that, over there. Now, don't say a word. Just look at me out of the corner of your eye. Words are so often the source of misunderstanding. But you will sit a little closer, day unto day." And so he did, and gradually, the little prince tamed the fox. Ruhl Howe has written an arresting book entitled The Miracle of Dialogue, in which he catches the spirit of the little prince, because he insists that the language of relationship, the language of mutual address and response, of trust and love, must be correlated with the language of words. The Master knew this. And he who was in the business of taming human hearts even the wildest and most demon-possessed, became a friend of publicans and sinners. He gained entree into their homes and social gatherings and banquet halls and their innermost beings because he met the deepest needs of their lives. The gossip rampant on Jesus during the days of his Galilean ministry was this: whatever your needs are, this Jesus meets them. Despite his rugged schedule, that busy itinerary, the Master had time for people. He had time for the lonely, the discouraged and despondent. He had time for the outcast, the scum of the earth, the untouchables. He had time for impertinent young men with their doubts and disillusionment. He had time for the ill, for the wounded, the dying. He had time for even sanctimonious Pharisees and smug intellectuals. And of course, he even had time for little children with their skin knees and runny noses. A young woman on a Texas campus had time for a certain Chinese student. The two became very dear friends. The Christian disciple became involved in all the cares and concerns, the delights and dreams of this Chinese girl. After 2 years of deep personal friendship, the Chinese student became a Christian. After her baptism, some fellow students approached her, and they said, "Whatever convinced you that you ought to change religion? What argument did Julie use?" And she replied, "Julie never argued, but Julie built a bridge of love between her heart and mine, and one day Jesus walked across it." Indeed, it is only as we come to mean something to people on an interpersonal level that they begin to take what we say about Jesus seriously. It is then that this gospel transmission or faith dispersion begins to take place. We must be patient to work through the barriers of misunderstanding and hostility. Surely everyone knows that if he wishes to mend an inner tube, he has to let the air out before he can make repairs. We must sit where they sit, even as Ezekiel sat by the captives of Babylon, earning the right to be heard. We must travail with them on their painful spiritual pilgrimages until Christ is formed within. When Choyu Tsutsui left Tokyo, he had shelved his ancestral faith to be converted to modern secularism. Upon his arrival in the States, he wanted desperately to improve his English, so he began studying with this missionary. Every week, assignments were made in the text, Living Gospels, a modern translation of the scriptures. In the early stages of the dialogue, Choyu Tsutsui insisted that he did not believe in the existence of God. He refuted the validity of the Bible. The teacher simply refused to hurl dogmatic propositions indiscriminately at the head of this unbeliever. But the months elapsed, and she sought to convey the character and personality of Jesus and let him speak, as it were. "What manner of man is this?" is a question that Jesus Christ is capable of compelling upon every generation and upon every race of people, however predisposed they may be to the ultimate answer. It was not the consciousness of sin that brought him to Jesus, but the continual contact with the Christ brought him to an awareness of his sin, to his great undoneness, as the Japanese say. And he cried out for God's deliverance. "We would see Jesus" is still the cry of the human heart. And as Kenneth Cragg, missionary to the Muslim world, has said, "We have no New Testament right to require orthodoxy before we present Jesus." So many times I fear that the crystal Christ is buried beneath our dead orthodoxies, superficial discipleship, all kinds of man-made obstructions, religious formalism, etc., etc. But oh, that we might present a Christ as fresh and as untrampled as the one that greeted Mary Magdalene on that first Easter morn. Surely within every human heart there is a Christ-shaped void. God is perennially busy with all men. As Niles declares, God is in constant dialogue with all men. Christian faith is not communication between two persons, but the invisible third partner, the Holy Spirit, is the primary one. We are merely witnesses to his transforming love. Jesus said to the 70 evangelists in Luke 10, according to one modern translation, "Whoever listens to you is listening to me." Now, is it so that whoever listens to you is thereby listening to God? Then we must get people to listen to God's voice in us. But how? By establishing ties, building bridges of love, identifying with the struggles of mankind. Thus we become laborers together with the Holy Spirit of God in the glorious task of taming human hearts the world over.
Two books. Saint Exupery's The Little Prince and The Family of Man have come to me to be illustrative of sensitive people. I'm convinced in days like this that God warmed hearts in sensitive men, or at least a large part of the answer for which we seek. Some of you have heard the story, perhaps, of a fellow who stood one night about midnight on a bridge overlooking a dark, surging river. He stood and thought about the world, about his life, and contemplated suicide. Coming from the city, a passerby saw him standing there and touched him on the shoulder. Said to him, "Come, there's a cafe at the end of the bridge. Let's go and talk it over." And so they did. And as they drank cup after cup of coffee and tried to see the world as it really was, without rose-colored glasses or without the spectacles of the cynic, as they tried to examine life and themselves as it really was, there built between them a sense of community. They were thinking alike. They paid for the coffee, got up as the dawn was breaking, and walked back across that bridge toward the lights in the city, which were now going out. As they came to the center of the bridge, they looked at each other, thought of their conversations in which they had examined the world carefully, objectively, and both jumped over. I'm thankful that the picture Ross Coggins and other folk on the program this weekend has not been this picture of the world. I'm thankful that we come to an awareness of a troubled world, and yet rather than jumping over, we find ourselves saying, let's jump in. This morning we come to think in these closing moments of faith dispersed. Let me make one explanation. I carry the role of missionary. My comments, however, will be addressed and related to you and your church in your place. Why? Because I am absolutely convinced that a large part of our ineffectiveness in this day, a major segment of our problems in overseas work, and a great percentage of our own restlessness and unhappiness with ourselves can be traced to the church in your place. This is where we learn to be sons of God. from my mountain in the western part of this state comes a story of a little fellow who was in his first year, 9 or 10 or 11 years old, who adopted as his hero a massive, powerfully built, rugged mountaineer individual. And he almost worshiped this fellow. Anytime he could, he followed this fellow around with eyes big and with appreciation deep. But each time, if he had a chance to say anything, his conversation would always come back to the same thing. It was, "Boy, if I was as big as you, I'd go in them woods and find me the biggest bear I could find, and I'd wrestle him and break his neck." Now, the big mountaineer appreciated the worship that the little fellow had, the evident admiration, but this sort of prodding eventually got on his nerves. One day, after his little friend had leaned back and looked up and said, "Boy, if I was you, if I was as big and strong as you, I'd go out in them woods and find me the biggest bear I could and rattle him till I broke his neck." The mountaineer couldn't resist and said, "Sonny, there's lots of bears in them woods just about your size." Some of you are interested in overseas work. Some of you are interested in work in a geographical setting other than where you are now. The fact of the matter is, where you are, within your kin, there are lots of bears just about your size. Regularly, we're hearing in these days discussion groups and pulpits in which the word "disperse" is a major one. Get out. Go. Be missionary. This is something we hear again and again and again. I would submit, however, that before these words can become reality, we must give attention to some prerequisites to dispersal. Three things I want us to focus upon in these moments. An essential presupposition, some reason for dispersal, and some thought about sustenance while we're out. Without these, our going out will not, in fact, be faith dispersed. We've heard a lot recently about the church in the world. Let's think for a moment, if you please, about the church in the world. The fact of the matter is, most of us are dispersed. Most of us have labs with folks who do not profess Jesus Christ. Most of us have contact with and associations with and involvement in the structures of our world. There are Christians in legislatures. There are Christians in unions. There are Christians in business. The question is, not are we dispersed, but in the process, do we know who we are? Do we understand the structures in which we operate? I think Ross Coggins has said pointedly, and I'll not attempt to belabor the point, that it behooves us as Christians to understand these structures, to know something of the problem, to add to our piety, if you please, worldly wisdom. An essential presupposition. God is at work in the world. There is nothing secular to God. God is at work in the world. There is nothing secular to God. All of us admit this readily, at least intellectually.
But when we get down to the nitty-gritty of it, our whole orientation is a bring them in one. When I was a pastor, in spite of my best efforts, I tend to evaluate people on the basis of their participation in the organization of which I was the stackpole. When I became a student director, again, the same temptation was with me to evaluate folk on the basis of their participation in the organization of which I was a central figure. When I say that deep down, we have not come to grips with the fact that God's at work in the world, a large part of the responsibility lies on the shoulders of our religious leaders. I remember not long ago, I talked with an associational missionary. He had just approached an individual about heading up a new work in juvenile delinquency in a particular community. And the man's answer was, "I'm awfully sorry, I can't do it." Why? You're interested in young people. You've shown some evidence of creative contact with young people. Why can't you do it? "I'm too busy with RAs in my church." Somewhere down the line, somebody had failed to share with this man the fact that God was at work in places other than the four walls of a church building. We feel about our church, or now this I would say here includes a student group as well as a local congregation, that if we can't get them here, we can't help them. These are Carlisle Martin's words, and pointed words they are. This is our philosophy. If we can't get them here, we can't help them. We are affirming thereby that God works only where organ music and push rugs and dress up clothes and dress up smiles are in vogue. We think God too is caught up in our eat, meet, and retreat treadmill. And it just ain't so. I said that the religious leaders bear a large part of responsibility here, but let's face it, they aren't the only ones. You and I like it because somehow in the process, if we can chain God to the communion table, there's a certain sense of freedom which we find in our everyday life. Just as surely as I memorized the pictures in my roommate's Playboy magazine when he was in lab or safely in class, just as surely as this occurs, there is something in us that likes to feel that God doesn't have but one pair of pants. He takes them out on Sunday and always is involved in the sanctuary or the church place. Not a sufficient, but certainly a necessary prerequisite then to dispersal is the visceral level conviction that God is in business anywhere there's air or water or neither. It would be foolish for me here to try to attempt any logical or theological or scriptural or evidential proof of the fact. We as Christians know it. The difference is, if you please, whether or not we're turned on as a result of it. God is at work everywhere men are. This is our essential presupposition. We turn now to reason for dispersal.
I offer for consideration two of several which might be adduced. The first is an assurance of value. Here we have to ask the question, what? What is of real value? Is it participation in an organization? We've answered this question. No. For if this is of ultimate value, we are again caught up in our treadmill of organizational involvement, simply going on hunting expeditions occasionally to bring them in. The organization is not of ultimate value. What is it then that we can affirm as valuable, as ultimately valuable, as really significant, as inherently of consequence? Denomination? No. How about personal morality? These are words I've heard a lot lately.
Those of us in the Raleigh area hear Jesse Helms occasionally, and he emphasizes
personal morality. Personal morality. I've heard it from another place.
In John Birch films I've been viewing, and in speeches I've heard given by members of the John Birch Society.
Is personal morality the thing then that is of basic inherent significance?
Now watch it. You're not going to catch me arguing against personal morality,
but I have to say two things. To begin with, the Birch presentation ties personal morality in as one of the pillars of Americanism.
And we're getting here the cart before the horse, and this is as dangerous as it's possible to be. Second thing is that in many cases, personal morality is seen as too personal and not enough moral.
Paul dealt with this, you remember, in the second chapter of Colossians when he said, why are you who are dead to Christ so involved with don't touch this and don't taste that and don't handle the other thing? These, he said, are fine as far as the development of willpower, but inherently significant? Absolutely not.
Well, personality is not that valuable. Excuse me, if personal involved personal morality is not that valuable, what about social concern? Here we have it, we say.
Social concern, this is the thing we're concerned about.
No. It's essential, I would say.
But if this is of ultimate value, then it may well be that someplace other than the church is where we need to get involved.
Now let me back up and say, I'm afraid in many cases we are losing out here.
The men with the greatest social conscience on the campus where I'm studying, in many cases, are the SDS folks.
And I can't agree with them for a number of reasons.
The men in a number of churches that read the most and understand the most about the structures are the John Birchers. And I can't agree with them. Social concern per se, though important, though essential, I feel, is not basic, is not inherently significant.
What then
can we affirm as of real value? What can we affirm as of inherent significance for us, for other men, for God?
I submit that it be the sons of God.
Partaking of all we exist to be,
of the very breath and nature of God.
Be
the sons of God. We could spend all the time between now and my 8:30 class in the morning, or between now and your 9 o'clock class in the morning, talking about what it means to be a son, who God is, and what the significance of being is. I assume you've thought some about this. Here we are.
an essential presupposition to dispersion. God is in business in the world. One reason for dispersal, an assurance of the significance of being the sons of God. A second reason for dispersal is concern for the world. Concern for the world. Let me pause here, if I may, to raise a question about dominion. There was a time when the world meant China. And we were focused so intently on the world, China, that we couldn't see the mills and the opera houses in our own front door. Now, I'm afraid it's possible that the world for many of us has been narrowed to the mills and the slums and the opera houses, so that we aren't able to see China. God's in business in China. And until there comes in the mind of Christians an interest in and a concern for Mao Zedong or LBJ or Stokely Carmichael and the structures which they represent, we are looking at less than the world. I'm talking about dimension here, and I'm talking about concern. In similar fashion, just as yesterday we focused so intently upon China that we couldn't see our own neighborhood, so today I think it's possible that we look out the window at our neighborhood so intently that we don't see the men and women leaning against the wall in the room where we stand. In these days, if there are any folks who are unnoticed, it's the group of people who aren't on the cutting edge, so to speak, as we like to call ourselves in the church, and yet are quite outside. The wallflowers of BSU. The folk who are within our organization, but who are not really in the process of interaction, of dialogue, of understanding, as we attempt to hammer out who we are and where we're going. Make no mistake about it, these folk, in spite of the fact we're thinking about dispersal with such force that we hope the suction will draw them in, make no mistake about it, unless we find ourselves concerned about them as God is concerned about them, they'll be there a long time after we're gone. Shall I put it this way? God is just as concerned about the local church, just as concerned about the constituency of a BSU group, as he is about the rest of the world. We need to be a part of that concern. Concern for the world. I stood not too long ago in a little country church and sang a hymn that I've sung numerous times, and you sung it too. The group was almost leaning back as we were singing, "Throw Out the Lifeline." And suddenly I realized what it was that was bugging me about this hymn. In the first place, it shot through with the haul 'em in philosophy. In the second place, and more important, there is no element of shirt wetting, body chilling, eye stinging involvement in the whole hymn. Maybe that's why we can sing it with such gusto. As we sit back on our yacht and think about throwing out a rope or a life preserver and hauling folks in, making sure they change their clothes and put on a tie before they come in contact with us.
in order that we don't get wet. I'm talking about concern. I guess, in Al Capp's words, you can't quamp it up. The fact of the matter is, you love because you have been and are received love. This leads me to comment upon two elements of sustenance in dispersion. We can preach and teach about dispersion until 12 o'clock every Sunday morning. We can infiltrate labor and management, government and big business so thoroughly that we make the communists look like children playing games. But unless there's some real sustenance for us when we get there, we'll be like so many ants in a bowling alley. Now, I realize all analogies are false, but let me change the analogy for a moment and attempt to make one point. Suppose we are a squad of men who have been ordered to move into a position in enemy territory. And so we set out, wading rivers, sloshing through rice paddies, cutting our way through jungle, under the cover of night, and in sub-zero weather, inching our way into position. And here we are. And we turn to take stock and suddenly realize that weapons and radio and food and helmet and even our contact lenses without which we cannot see are left behind. We're there. So what? Thing I want to say this morning, which I feel in these days is as important or more important than anything else, is that just getting there isn't sufficient. We've got to know who we are when we get there. And our getting there has got to be in response to God. All power is given me in heaven and earth. As you go, therefore. Without this, we'd better stay home. At least we're rather innocuous within the four walls of the church. Important here, then, is our relationship with God. Nothing can be a substitute for a relationship with God. Neither wattage, nor filament, nor size, nor complexity, nor design, nor beauty, nor shape, nor anything else can be a substitute for a live socket if you need a trouble light on a dark night when your car won't start. Nothing is a substitute for a relationship with God. The second thing, and I'm pushing at this moment, I feel a bit like the Egyptian mummy, hard pressed for time. The second thing is that sustenance is essential. And a large part of this will be Christian community. To say to you, disperse, without providing Christian community in its deepest sense for you, is like telling my two-year-old, get out and fight, and pushing him out on the basketball court with a bunch of fellows that hang out over Chapel Hill. Now, Clemson can take care of them, apparently, unfortunately, because there's some community and there's some knowledge about the structures. My two-year-old by himself would have little to show. To say, disperse, get out, go,
without providing at the same time some succor is ridiculous.
Any proponent of faith dispersal must address himself first to the question of survival techniques. Christian community is essential. I'm not going to attempt to say how to build Christian community. I'm simply saying we have in days like this an essential presupposition. God is at business in the world. At least two reasons for dispersal. An assurance of the inherent significance of being sons of God. And the concern for the world that grows out of having been the object of God's concern and be at present the object of God's concern. Some sustenance as we go in terms of relationship with God and Christian community. So, study groups are better than ping pong, but they aren't the answer. Positive ethical values are better than negative preachment, but that's not sufficient. Less organization based on the job to be done may be of more value than more organization simply because some manual demands it. But that's not what Christian faith is about. Social concern is to be desired above self-centered naivete, but that's not the total picture either. In your subculture, there are imperfect structures. There are incomplete and lonely individuals. And God is there. The days ahead, regardless of your status, regardless of your profession, if they are to be really significant, must find you at study as you go. Learning your inadequacies by working to the end of your rope. Caught up in the experience of prayer as you are involved in situations that can't be redeemed except by prayer. Disciplining yourself with your fellow Christians in worship, openness of life, confession of sin, and self-gift. Ultimately, living out an active dependence upon and commitment to Him who promises that you will run and not be weary, that you will walk and not faint. Years ago, I went from my home in the mountains on my first debating trip. It was the first time I'd been away from home. I really expected my dad to give me a sermon. Man, I'd been sort of just cringing, thinking what he would say for several days. The day came, and we sat down in the living room and talked. The car was to pick me up in a little while. And we talked a while, and he didn't get to the sermon. And I began to wonder, well, now, has he forgotten that I'm leaving? Is he losing his marble? Still not. And the car pulled up in front of the house, and I heard a horn blow, and I stood up and reached down and picked up my suitcase, and he came to the door and stuck out his hand. And as I walked out the door, he said, "Son, remember, you've got my name." Faith dispersed. There is no faith undispersed. Smugness becomes faith only as it moves out. Fear becomes faith only as it invests itself in danger. Knowledge becomes faith only as it is existentially involved. And your name is Christian only as your joined hearts let you drop your hands and follow Him who proclaims, "Lo, I go before you." Shall we pray?
take us out of ourselves, our Father. Somehow change our mirrors into women. Make us know who we are. Help us to see where you are. And give us courage to be there too.